Hello and welcome to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com. I'm Richard Moore, the author of Sky's the Limit and Tour de France 100. And I'm joined tonight by Lionel Burney, the publisher of Sean Kelly's autobiography and the editor of the cycling anthology. Sadly, Daniel Freeb is not with us this evening. Rather terrible thing happened to Daniel today. He was driving along the motorway between Nice and Marseille when a couple of boxes appeared bowling along towards him, and they'd fallen off a lorry in front, smashed the wing mirror off the car, and I think might have smashed the windscreen as well. Anyway, he's off getting a replacement car. Thankfully, he and his passengers were okay. Nobody was hurt. Lionel, can you tell us a little bit of where we are today?
We're on the outskirts of Marseille, just off the grounds of a horse racing track by the looks of it. I can see the grandstand over there and the track, which looks like it could do with a bit of grass on it. There's also a Ferris wheel, not unlike a small version of the London Eye on the horizon as well.
So pretty sure it's not the London Eye.
It's not the London Eye, that's in London. But yeah, we're just outside the press room this evening. We haven't managed to find anywhere nearby for a cold beer. Yeah.
It would have felt inappropriate perhaps after Daniel's troubles today to be, you know, drinking beer while he's sweating at Marseille Airport trying to get a replacement car.
I would have felt bad about that for a couple of moments.
Yeah. So tonight, Lionel and I are going to be talking Mark Cavendish, talking a bit of Marseille. We've got some fascinating stories about Marseille. We think they're fascinating anyway. We'll talk a little bit about Ted King, who sadly eliminated and didn't start today. A bit about Geraint Thomas, who battles on. We've also got a competition winner to announce from yesterday, and we're going to be announcing a very exciting new competition to win a phone call from David Miller. We've also got interviews with Brian Holm and Geraint Thomas. That's quite a packed little programme we've got
there. We'd
better
get on with it.
We'd better get on with it. Mark Cavendish then. So, stage five, I worked out that it's the fourth occasion that has taken Mark Cavendish till stage five to win his first stage of the tour. That's not particularly unusual, but it was, a very, very impressive win by him today. We often say that, but, you know, Cavendish wins are often very impressive. But it was very convincing. As he always does, he paid tribute to his team, Omega Pharma Quickstep, afterwards, who did a fantastic job. He said, including Tony Martin, who's got about 2% of his skin left, which might be a slight exaggeration, but he's certainly in a pretty bad shape, or a pretty bad way, should I say. But he did a power of work coming through Marseille, as did Sylvain Chavanel, and Stegman's perfect lead out at the end. I thought for a while that some of the other lead out trains were getting involved, and it could be quite messy, because there are a number of very good lead out trains here, Lotto, Bellisol, Argos, Shimano. But in the end, it looked pretty straightforward for Cavendish.
It did, and it was one of the things I thought about today was the way they worked. They worked a lot more like the HTC Columbia team used to for Cavendish. And I think culturally it's taken a little bit of time for the Omega Pharma riders to kind of really buy into this teamwork ethos and actually, you know, empty everything out in those final few kilometres. I mean, Sylvain Chavanel, he's not work shy by any sense of the imagination, but he is not used to doing that kind of work for a prolonged period of time for another ride. And I think certainly when Cavendish first joined the team, you know, they're a Belgian team, and although not all the riders are Belgian, there is that culture within it, I gather, that riders don't want to work hard up to the last sort of 2 kilometres, 1500 metres, and then drift in at the back. It goes against what they're in bike racing for, which is to finish well up in the pack and show themselves in the finale. But I thought today almost marked a sort of watermark change in the way that team's operating.
Yeah, I mean, I remember in the old days of HTC when Mark Renshaw was Cavendish's lead out man, and there was some talk at the time, you know, how much does his prolific rate of winning owe to Mark Renshaw? And I think the question then was, is Mark Renshaw making Mark Cavendish look like a better sprinter? I'm tempted now to say that Mark Cavendish makes Mark Renshaw or Gert Steegmans look like a better lead-out man. Mm. You know, there, Gert Steegmans did do a great job for him today, but an awful lot of that, I think, is having the, so much confidence in the guy sitting on your wheel. It's very interesting watching those two because Steegmans is massive and Cavendish is quite small. You almost couldn't see him sitting behind Steegmans. Mm. And you just have to look at them to know that if they can click, they can be a very effective pair.
Absolutely. It's a perfect jigsaw fit, isn't it? The big guy doing all of that work and leaving Cavendish completely protected from the wind. And the other teams, you know, they did try. Greipel's team, Lotto Bellisol, they mounted a pretty good sort of counter move down the other side of the road to Omega Pharma. But in the end,
which at one point I thought was going to overwhelm Omega Pharma. And I did ask Brian Hall afterwards about, you know, what you do as a team if you have a plan and you see other teams coming up, what you should, whether you should stick to your own plan and stick to what you know about the finish or be influenced by the team that's coming up. I spoke to Brian Holm after the stage and here's what he had to say. Is that a very important role that Tom Steele plays for you? Does he recce the stage finishes every day?
Oh, yes. I mean, he's a sprinter. I think he won 14 stages at Tour de France. He can tell Kev exactly when he has to kick off, you know, when he has to start sprinting. I mean, I would like to do it. I did a few sprint myself, but not at that level yet. So you have to be like Robbie McEwen, Tom Steele, or Erik Sarpen to be out there and say, you're going to sprint, you're going to start your sprint at 175 meter or 200 because you have tailwind, so on, or wait a little bit longer because of headwind. And then you need a like old school sprinter because I wouldn't have the balls to do it.
How does he relay that information? When does he do the recce? Is it in the morning or?
No, he does it ahead because you have to do
the
it
day
like
before or?
No. Now what? Because the wind direction is changing also, so we needed like a half an hour fresh reports, you know, so like a half an hour he's up the road, 45 minutes, you know.
Okay. And then it's just over the radios.
He's texting. He always texting, you know. And so we got all the info and we're telling the riders dangerous point down his tricky roundabouts, you know. So,
is there? Do you communicate that to say one rider, or do you communicate it to all of the
to
riders?
Everybody.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with HumansInvent.com and Sharp.
So that was Brian Holm talking a little bit about today's stage. And just to carry on a little bit on today's stage and Mark Cavendish, I was struck by something he said at the end, and by something that his director, Rolf Aldag, said. He noted that some of the teams, Lotto Bellisol for André Greipel and Cannondale, I think, for Peter Sagan, rode very hard towards the final climb, the Col de la Jeunesse, which wasn't actually a categorised climb. But they knew that it was quite difficult and that they might get rid of Cavendish on that climb. I think they also rode hard up the one before that, the categorised one, to try and get rid of him. And an interesting thing that Cavendish said in the press conference afterwards was that he recognised the climb as soon as he hit it, that he'd ridden it in 2007 in his first professional race, the GP Marseillaise, which was won by Jeremy Hunt. And it does tell you, this is something that we know time and time again with Cavendish, the detail that he can remember about stages or races that he's ridden in the past, that he could recognise a climb that he last raced up 6 years ago, albeit it was his first race that maybe left a deeper impression. But he does have this kind of brain that seems to be able to remember, recall details that will, you know, that he can use. And I think he knew as soon as they hit it, he knew that he could hang on up that climb, and he was helped a bit by his team, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it demonstrates the level of thought, the level of detail that comes kind of naturally to Cavendish. You know, that's just the way his brain works. I'm not saying it's something that he necessarily has to work really hard at. It's just he's a bike racer and he takes in details, you know, about the terrain that he's racing over, whether it's in a small race or a big race. And you know, he knows this area of France well. He knows, you know, how to race on these roads. And, you know, Montpellier, I'm pretty certain he's won in Montpellier before. I don't know whether he's won on this.
Was it Montpellier in 2000? And did the stage finish in Montpellier in 2009 when, after the crosswinds? That was Montpellier, wasn't it?
Was that not further down the coast? Was that not
La Grande Motte,
I think, yeah.
You could be right, we'll check that.
But I'm pretty sure he's won in Montpellier. But
Not sure. I think the last bunch sprint before that, as I mentioned in the podcast last night, probably incorrectly. I made a few mistakes in my interview with Tan Man, sadly. But he kind of threw me a little bit.
Was that the one with the...
But it was Robbie Hunter, 2007.
When there was a big crash on the roundabout.
There was a big crash, and the man leading out Robbie Hunter, or certainly did a lot of work for him on the way into Montpellier, was a certain Geraint Thomas, actually.
That's right.
Got an interview with Geraint Thomas later on, riding his first tour as the youngest rider in the race. We heard from Brian Holm as well about the work done by Tom Steels, who won. Brian Holm claimed that he'd won 14 stages of the tour. He actually won 9 stages of the tour as a sprinter. He was a good sprinter. Now he's a coach with Omega Pharma Quickstep, and he is somebody who goes out and you know, obviously recces the final parts of the stages. I mean, it's one thing. Eric Zabel used to do it for Cavendish at HTC Columbia. It's one thing having that information, being told that information. It's quite another to be able to process it in the way that Cavendish seems to be able to process it and use it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't think they're the only team that are doing that.
No.
It's just that, you know, Cavendish's eye for detail and his recall is appears to be a cut above some of the others. And you know, they say in football that the first yard of a player's pace is in his head, and I think the same could be applied to a cycling sprinter.
Mm. I don't. He did say afterwards that he didn't have to do much to win to the end. That, for once, you tempted to agree with him. He was, you know, put in the right position. Stevens did a great job. It was about 150 metres before Cavendish appeared, I think. Mm. So, you know, for once, his praise of his teammate seemed to be fully justified rather than just partially justified.
So he's off and running, and now it's a case of whether he'll add number 2 tomorrow.
Indeed.
This is a humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast with Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
So we're in Marseille, as we mentioned. And Marseille has a rich history, a rich association with the Tour, although there is a bit of a gap. The Tour didn't visit Marseille between 1971 and 1989. And had Daniel been here, it would have been interesting to get him to tell us this story, because it features in his wonderful book, The Cannibal, his biography of Eddy Merckx. And it's a great story, and I'll just sort of set the scene for that. But 1971... there was a stage of the Tour that finished in Marseille, and it came after a mountain stage to Orsières. And on that mountain stage, Merckx's great rival for that Tour, the Spaniard Luis Ocaña, was aggressive all day. He attacked quite early on in the Côte de l'Afre, which is a very steep climb, and he eventually won up the climb in Orsières by 8 minutes. Some people say that it was one of Merckx's greatest performances, even though he was beaten by such a huge margin. He spent a lot of that stage just chasing on the front of the bunch. Nobody would help him. He didn't have any teammates, and it was a lone pursuit of Ocaña. But he did lose 8 minutes, and it did look as though he'd lost the Tour. A great quote from Jacques Gaudet, who was the director of the Tour at the time, who said, "Nothing will ever be the same again. If the beautiful bird has been deplumed, he will probably still be the eagle of the sport for some time. But he's no longer out of reach. He will no longer be able to dictate the outcome of races and the way they are won on his own at the command of his omnipotence."
Poetic stuff from Gaudet there, who was a journalist, of course.
He did coin the term Merckxissimo to describe Merckx in 1969, his first Tour, when he won that astonishing stage in the Pyrenees alone. Merckx, you know, 8 minutes conceded to Ocaña. He's basically out of the Tour. But the next stage was won to Marseille. Now, in Daniel's wonderful book, he has a claim that another rider, whose name I cannot remember, the following morning, heard a whirring noise coming from the basement of Merckx's hotel. He went down to investigate and discovered Merckx warming up on a set of rollers. Now, this was, in those days, highly unusual. Still is quite unusual, actually, but in those days it was unheard of. And especially because the stage began at the top of the mountain, Orsières. So what was Merckx up to? Well, when they went to line up, he positioned himself with several teammates right at the front of the bunch, while Ocaña in the yellow jersey was mucking about at the back. And from the gun, again, highly unusual, especially on a descent, Merckx attacked. He went at full pelt, took a few teammates with him. What followed was basically a pursuit match. The entire 251-kilometre stage to Marseille It was Merckx at the front with a couple of teammates and Ocaña chasing hard behind him. One of the quotes from relating to the start of that stage was that Merckx went off like an atomic bomb. There were nine of them altogether. The lead hovered between 1 and 2 minutes, so it never threatened to reach the kind of lead that Ocaña had had the previous day. But they went so fast that day that they arrived in Marseille so far ahead of schedule that there was nobody really out watching by the time they arrived. And crucially, those missing from the crowd were the mayor of Marseille, Gaston Defferre, who was lunching with his VIP guests and was extremely angry when he learned what had happened.
So they missed the entire race because
they
were
missed
still
having the
lunch.
Race. Yeah, they missed the race. So he actually said, the Tour de France will never set foot in this city again as long as I live. Now, Defferre died in 1986. Not laughing about him dying, but he died in 1986, and it was 89 before the Tour visited again.
Just to put this in context, I mean, Marseille, one of the biggest cities in France.
Mm, yeah, it was quite a significant...
On the route of the 1903 Tour, the very first Tour. And so for a city of this size to go without the Tour for...
A long time.
What was that, 18 years? I mean, yeah. that is quite unusual.
And you've got a story about its return in 1989, Lionel, but just to finish that, because that 1971 Tour was a famous one, Ocaña obviously was still in the yellow jersey after that stage. Merckx only gained 2 minutes and 12 seconds. It was insignificant, but, and again, this is detailed in Daniel's book, one or two people felt, I think his witness to this was actually Andy and Frank Schleck's brother, Johnny, who was a teammate of Merckx, and he reckoned after that stage that Ocaña had been broken. He looked destroyed psychologically. And it was on that same tour, when they reached the Pyrenees on the Col de Monte, where Ocaña had a crash. He and Merckx both overshot a corner, and then he was poleaxed by probably Joop Zoetemelk, although the identity of the rider who hit Ocaña has never been conclusively proven, I don't think. Ocaña was taken to hospital, and he was out the tour. But his injuries weren't actually as bad as feared, and he did come out of hospital the next day. So there has been a story or a myth that's sprung out of that tour, which is that he was more psychologically than physically destroyed by Merckx and by the crash, and that was his tour over. He did come and win it in 73, I think, when Merckx was missing.
That's right.
But it was a very famous tour, and... I love the story of the stage to Marseille. I think it's brilliant. It sums up so much about Eddy Merckx, I think.
It sums up so much about France. You can't come between a Frenchman,
yeah,
a Frenchman and his lunch. But you're right about 1989, when the Tour did return to Marseille. It did so in style. It was on Bastille Day, the French national holiday, of course, and they were coming from Montpellier to Marseille. And for those that don't know, the 1989 Tour was already brewing up into this fantastic battle between Laurent Fignon of France and the American Greg LeMond, and they were split by only a handful of seconds after the Pyrenean stages, and this was supposed to be a kind of calm transitional stage across the flattish south before the final battles in the Alps. And but with it being Bastille Day, the French were likely to be pretty motivated towards the end, but there wasn't a great appetite for racing among the other teams early on. So LeMond and Fignon separated by a few seconds, Fignon in the yellow jersey, but just behind those two in the overall, the Dutch PDM team had four riders in the top 10, Gert-Jan Terneser, Stephen Rooks, Raoul Alcala and Sean Kelly of Ireland. And in the morning, their team director gathered them all round and gave a team talk. His name was Jan Gisbers, and his team talk was, his instruction was that the PDM team was to attack in the feed zone because strong winds had been predicted, and just after the feed zone they were going to turn direction in the road and the wind would be coming from the side, which would potentially split the bunch. And PDM hoped to not necessarily catch out LeMond or Fignon, but perhaps catch out Pedro Delgado or one of the other riders and perhaps leapfrog a few places up the overall classification before the Alps. Now, attacking in the feed zone is a big no-no, as we all know, because it's basically where the riders are slowing down to grab their lunch bags and water bottles. It's dangerous, stuff gets dropped, everyone's weaving all over the place trying to find their soigneur. And so the riders were pretty uneasy about this. There wasn't a great deal of appetite.
The PDM riders.
The PDM riders were pretty uneasy about this. There wasn't much appetite for...
It wouldn't win them many friends.
It certainly wouldn't. But a team order is a team order. And as they were approaching the feed zone, Kelly kind of tried to rally a couple of guys. And the plan was, I think, for Mark Van Orzo, a sort of domestique, and one of the other domestiques, to cause the chaos in the feed zone and get to the front and drill the pace. For whatever reason, they were reluctant to do it, and so Kelly decided he'd get to the front, get on with it, follow the team order. They set the pace through the feed zone, lots of shouting and swearing at them. They drilled it to the bend in the road. They turned at the bend in the road, and the wind just wasn't as strong as they had hoped. So the chaos and the splits that they'd hoped to provoke didn't happen. So they eased off a bit, and they got hell's abuse from the rest of the peloton. As you can imagine, they slipped back into the group. And Kelly was apologising, and some of the others were apologising, and it was Laurent Fignon, the yellow jersey, on Bastille Day. He didn't appreciate this very much.
Mm.
And as Kelly says, he called him every name under the sun. And Fignon was quick to anger, anyway, at the best of times, but this really riled him. So everything calms down, the peloton's rolling along for another few kilometres, and then there's another increase in pace, and Kelly wants to find out what's going on, and it turns out that Fignon, the yellow jersey, has now attacked on this flat stage with Charlie Motte, another Frenchman.
And a teammate?
No, not a teammate.
Oh, were they
the
not
time,
teammates?
No. Motte
well,
was
he
RMO,
was at RMO, wasn't
and,
he?
And
then,
Fignon
yeah.
was Sorry. Super U. Yeah. Nevertheless, the French public on the roadside were delighted.
Very strong rider, Motte.
The people watching at home on TV must have thought this was some kind of special Bastille Day celebration, not Fignon's retaliation at PDM. And so Delgado and LeMond and the other riders who were highly placed overall were suddenly thinking, well, we're going to lose a minute and a half, 2 minutes to Fignon here. This is a dangerous situation. But the peloton, angry at PDM, would not cooperate with them at all.
Mm.
So the PDM team basically had to get on the front, work extremely hard for a good 40 minutes. LeMond roped in a bit of help from a couple of his teammates, and they eventually brought Fignon and Motte back, but it was a heck of a chase. And once again, when Fignon and Motte were back in the bunch, the PDM riders were getting even more grief from the other riders. And at that point, Kelly thought it's just about to calm down when he sees Ternisa and Alcala, two of his PDM teammates, practically trying to pull each other off their bikes because Ternisa accused Alcala, a quite mercurial Mexican rider, of not putting his all into the chase.
Right.
Alcala resented this.
Alcala was at the centre of another fight, wasn't it? A famous cycling fight. In the Vuelta, there's a famous footage of two riders fighting in cleated shoes. Was that not...
I don't think that was Alcala.
Was that
no.
not Alcala?
No. We'd
Sorry.
Have to check on YouTube. But this particular day, all hell broke loose.
Mm.
And Kelly spent much of the rest of the day and a bit of the following morning apologising to people because, you know, as I say... Attacking in the feed zone is a complete no-no, especially
complete
on Bastille Day. Again, don't come between a Frenchman and his lunch.
The Tour de France with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
And I need to first of all say, having looked it up, it wasn't Raul Alcala. There's cracking YouTube footage of two riders fighting in the Tour of Spain in 1995. Can't identify who they are at the moment, but as a Carrera rider and a Benesto rider, it's great footage.
If anyone knows, tweet
yeah,
us.
Yeah, please let us know. In fact, if somebody can correctly identify both riders, they will get a free signed copy of my book, Tour de France 100. Please tweet me, at RichardMoore73. Thank you. Ted King didn't start today. He was outside the time limit by 6 seconds, 7 seconds?
7 seconds.
In the team time trial, and the judges ruled that he should be eliminated. A very strict interpretation of the rules. Sir Dave Brailsford said that they were following the letter of the rules, but not the spirit. And there is this question, you know, they are flexible with this rule from time to time, such as when a big group of riders eliminated the mountains, as I think they were in 2011, the Galibier stage. You know, then they apply some flexibility, some common sense, because that suits the race. Ejecting Ted King, a young, not young, quite an old American rider who may not be selected to ride the Tour again, this was his first time, doesn't do the race any good at all, does it? Doesn't benefit anybody?
Not really. It doesn't change the race one way or the other. It just gives a kind of a negative story for people to focus on. The head of the juries justification is that Ted King was dropped very, very early, within the first sort of few hundred metres of the time trial by his Cannondale team, and so therefore they couldn't justify applying exceptional circumstances to this case. But it's a particularly...
He did have crash injuries, didn't he?
He did have crash injuries, arguably caused by the organisation's decisions on that particular day. It just leaves a slightly... It's unfortunate for the race because it denies Ted King a story, the opportunity to kind of press on and see how far he can go.
We're also, I think there's a lot of sympathy for Ted King because he's quite a well-known and well-liked rider who writes very eloquently. And I think we all know, you know, what it meant to him to be riding the Tour. Neil Rogers, our colleague from Velo News, went and spoke to him this morning, and it was quite moving actually to hear just how upset and emotional he was. His parents had flown over yesterday from the States to see their son ride his first and possibly only Tour, and they arrived, and it was a big journey for them. I think his father's had some health issues, so it was a big undertaking for them to come here. And I think as Ted King told Neil this, he did become quite emotional. So, you know, that's sad on a human level, and as you say, I don't think it benefited the race. One rider who's still in the race, against all the odds, he had another difficult day today, actually had a puncture, and it took him a while to get back on, is Geraint Thomas from Team Sky. I spoke to Geraint at the start just about how he's dealing with his injury. He's got a broken bone in his pelvis. He was warming up at the time. Again, that's quite unusual. He wasn't planning an Eddy Merckx attack from the... He wasn't planning to go off like an atomic bomb at the start. He was just trying to get the blood flowing and to ease off his injury. So I spoke to him at the start, just outside Nice this morning, and here's what he had to say. How are you today? How's the injury?
Been worse. So,
have you? I suppose in Australia when you...
This is the worst injury for sure, but Sunday was just terrible, and Monday was bad as well, but yesterday felt a big improvement, probably because it was shorter, and the fact it's just one big burst, you know, one big adrenaline rush and one big fight, and then it's over. It felt like I could put out more power. You know, the first day was just 400 watts, I could hardly pedal with my left leg, like, because obviously the fracture's here, but... Everywhere around here was just, you know,
the whole area knackered. Around the injury.
Yeah, the whole like left side of my pelvis pretty much was just not really working. So yeah, felt like
you confirmed it a lot of us. So I mean, a lot of us were saying there'd be a battle for survival for you yesterday. I thought you'd be struggling to stay in the time limit.
Well, that's what I thought as well. I thought with the early corners, my race was just getting onto that promenade still with the team.
Yeah.
If I did that, then I'd be able to get to 15k to go, and then I'd be okay. So yeah, I was just super up for it. I'd had quite a lot of coffee. It was like an Olympic final for me. The start, just went full gas in the saddle pretty much all the way. And
do you still need help to get on the bike? Is that a particularly difficult part of your day?
It's not too bad now. I kind of learned the technique to do it, and get on with stand on my bad leg and then twist the good leg over, and then I'm okay then.
But do you feel? I mean, how do you feel today after that effort yesterday? Do you feel any improvement?
I saw this morning, definitely. When I woke up yesterday, I felt a lot better than the previous mornings, but this morning was sore again.
How are you sleeping?
Obviously. Sleep okay. It's not too bad to. Because there's no real weight on it then, and like on the saddle and stuff like this, it's fine because none of it is actually under much pressure. It was just the pedaling initially, but it's definitely improving day by day.
Are the doctor's confident that if you can get through a few days, the injury will start to heal and start to improve?
Well, yeah, they said that it won't make it worse by continuing. It's just a question of how quickly it improves and how quickly the pain sort of drops, subsides, and
Are you looking then, the next few days are relatively flat, and then Friday's, there's a climb, Saturday obviously the race in the Pyrenees, is that the real key stage for you if you can get that far?
Today and tomorrow are pretty much just try and take as easy as possible. Hopefully there's no wind and it's relatively flat. Hopefully, pretty stress-free, hopefully sprints. So try and get around them as easy as possible, really, and just take it super easy. And then yeah, Friday will be a breakaway day, so the first hour and a half there is going to be frantic, so a good warm-up on this, I think, before that. Because it definitely feels like after an hour and a half, it does get better. Maybe that's just getting used to the pain and just numbing a bit or whatever, but it does feel it improves. So
there's obviously, when you have any kind of problem, there's sort of, you're so restricted in what you can take. Is there any medication that you can take to ease the pain and help you sleep and stuff?
Not really, it's just ibuprofen, paracetamol,
coffee,
a lot of coffee, and just more just mental, just really just try and, you know, fight it, battle through it, and just stay positive. And obviously the physio, he's working a lot with me, just making sure that, you know, there's nothing he can do to speed up the recovery of the actual break, but he can keep my hips in line and keep me, you know, because it would be easy to overcompensate with.
Yeah, you know, that's when you would start to maybe do yourself damage.
And then that's when you pick up injuries, you know, on my knee and on the right side and all that type of stuff. So that's going all right so far as well. So
how long is the physio spending on you in the evening?
Get a massage and a good 45 minutes with the physio before the stage and after the stage.
And after.
On the bus and stuff as well, strapping me up and just to give that little extra bit of help.
What kind of strapping do you have on? I mean, what?
I've got, I don't really know what the mechanics behind it, but I've got two up here and then over my arse and then my lower back, my neck as well, just because, you know, I feel like this side is definitely working that bit, a little bit harder, so it's a lot of maintenance really.
This is the humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast, powered by Sharp.
Well, Richard, they're packing up the press room behind us, which is what that crashing and banging you can probably hear in the background is. We should perhaps take the hint and go and find somewhere.
There are a couple of guys who have appeared with glasses of beer
there
as well.
Are,
I wonder where they're getting that.
We should probably take our leave and go and try and find somewhere serving a good bouillabaisse fish stew in the old port in Marseille.
Is that your recommendation?
That's my recommendation for the evening. But before we go, yesterday we ran a competition to win a signed Garmin Sharp jersey. We asked people to tweet using the hashtag HumansInventTDF, who they thought today's stage winner would be. And quite a few people tipped Mark Cavendish for the win.
I'll give a wee shout-out first, before we announce the winner, to James Murley, who tipped Edvald Boasenhagen. I think he was the only one who tipped Edvald Boasenhagen, and he went pretty close.
He
didn't go close, but he was second.
No signed Garmin Sharp jerseys
or
for
cigar.
Second place.
No.
So the winner is, he goes by the Twitter handle, Little_Tom9.
Little Tom.
Little Tom, yeah.
And he's and his picture, if that's him, he's wearing a black and white, it might be a Newcastle shirt or a Juventus shirt, possibly.
We can't tell from here, but what we do know is that Little Tom has won a Garmin Sharp jersey, and the details of that will be on the humansinvent.com website by the time you've listened to this podcast.
Yes, indeed. Now, we're going to do another competition. This is very, very, very exciting. It's a phone call from David Miller. Now, David Miller is very good on the phone. He's a great guy to chat to on the phone.
He is. He has a second career in a call centre awaits. I'm joking. He's a great talker, and I'm sure whoever is the recipient of this
charming
phone call,
a charming man,
he will be able to ask him whatever they would like to ask him about the Tour de France or about any aspect of his life and career. I'm sure there are boundaries, but we trust our listeners to know where they lie.
We're not aware. No, we don't have a question. We have another hashtag. Now, the hashtag for this is... I've lost it.
The hashtag is Tour Moment.
Hashtag Tour Moment. Hashtag Tour Moment. And if you include in the tweet a Tour Moment, self-explanatory, just your favourite Tour Moment in fewer than 140 characters, hashtag Tour Moment. And a winner will be selected from those entries, and the lucky winner will receive a phone call on Monday, on the rest day, from David Miller. In week two, there will be a phone call from another rider, possibly Ryder Hesjedal or possibly Dan Martin. And week three is a phone call from Jonathan Vauters, the general manager of Garmin Sharp.
Now, that is something that I may enter myself.
there might be rules against that, Lionel, unless you set up a fake Twitter account. And I don't think you've ever done that, so we'll not have any entries from you. Thank you very much. Anyway, Lionel, if you can compose yourself, that's all for tonight, I think. We'll be back with Daniel tomorrow and other exciting guests, I'm sure, in his new vehicle.
I wonder what kind of car he'll get.
I wonder. But we're off for a fish stew.
Good night.
Goodbye.